Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is composer Sally Lamb. Lamb is an assistant professor of music composition at Ithaca College and artistic director of the Cool Music Contemporary Chamber Ensemble. Lamb has been the winner of numerous honors, including the Whitaker New Music Reading Sessions Award from the American Composers Orchestra and the Charles Ives Fellowship from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Lamb also started a Composer in the Schools program at Ithaca College. Welcome to the show, Sally.
It's great to be here, Tish.
Now, I want to know, was music always a part of your life from a very young age?
Yes, it was, and I don't even really remember learning about music. I think it was always a part of my life and a part of my family life.
Mm-hmm. So you have musicians in your family? Is that how you learned to love it, or you took it up yourself?
My mother played organ in our church when I was growing up, but we always had music in the home and listened to music. We went to a variety of different music ensembles. They held season tickets to the Detroit Symphony where I grew up, but I would also go to hear a black gospel choir at a local church, or they loved bluegrass, so we would go hear bluegrass.
Great.
And my brother plays guitar, and he's also a folk singer as well. So,
so you were taken by music at a young age.
I was.
You were interested, huh?
I don't remember not wanting to do it, or I've always loved it.
And then when did you actually begin composing?
Also at a very early age, I think, because my mom had decided to allow me to begin piano lessons not until I was the age of 7, and she sort of held me back in my mind anyways from that. And I think it's because my brother and sister kind of ruined it for me because they hated taking piano lessons, and she thought, oh, I've been down this road too many times, so we're just going to hold off for a while. But I was really drawn to it, and so I would just go to the piano and sort of make up my own, quote, songs, and even though I didn't really know what they looked like on paper. Mm-hmm. So I was already doing that, I guess, before I started taking lessons.
Uh-huh. And then when do you remember when you started actually composing seriously and writing it down? And
honestly, it probably really wasn't until college. I had started to write down some of my little pieces, when I was 10 and so forth. And my piano teacher at that point was really helpful in that she said, I won't listen to anything unless you have written it down, which was the best advice she could have ever given me. And so I would write things down and bring them to her. And she really couldn't comment on the artistry of the piece, but she could at least say, good job or something. And I would enter these little composers competitions for kids.
Really?
And I'd write things called like A Nice Day, or A Russian Dance. I'd never even seen Russians dancing, but
just out of your imagination.
Yeah. Or a piece called The Wind. But but then I think over time I probably just became more inhibited, as I think a lot of us do as we start growing older and became less comfortable playing things that weren't already on the page by somebody else. And I think there was a lot of second guessing. I just didn't have any direction. Mm-hmm. I was at that point in performance and played piano and actually the harp at that point.
Really?
Went into college as a harp performance major at University of Toronto. And then during my first semester, or in between my first and second semester, I broke my thumb, which is really bad news for a harpist, and then wound up with all this time on my hands, and I was taking all these music classes. So I started to get back into writing, and pretty much from then on, I realized this is me, and it was sort of like coming back to something that I had loved early on.
Oh, nice. So, some of those little accidents that happen in life are for a reason, aren't they?
It's true.
Absolutely.
When they happen, you hate the whole silver lining comment, but it's true, actually. So.
Wow. Now, how does a composition begin for you now that you have so much professional experience and have written so many pieces? Does it come from a line or an emotion?
I think each piece sometimes comes from a different thing. It's generated by something different. And I think, all of us, we all try to, we sort of wish we had it down, but I think each piece, has its own set of problems and might be inspired by something different, each time. Mm-hmm. It could be just a feeling, a mood that, I want to portray, but it also could be something visual that really inspires me. And then I think, oh, how would that translate into music? Wouldn't that be cool? Or it could just be a texture. And then again, there's you get all that stuff down, and then you have to start actually making it into mm-hmm. a piece.
Are composers often trying to capture what's in their heads in a music sense? It sounds mysterious to me.
Yeah, it does sound sort of mysterious, but I guess there are some basic principles that we sort of all adhere to. And I teach an introduction to composition class at Ithaca College for musicians who are non-composers or non-composition majors, but who are instrumentalists. And they've been surrounded by music all their lives, too, and they actually know a lot more than they think they do. You know, a lot of it is, a lot of times their intuition is quite good. And I think if I am able to sort of highlight sort of what they're doing and they start to understand what is already intuitive and then they sort of bring knowledge to that, you know, they are able to shape a piece and it becomes less mysterious along the way.
It is mysterious to me. Really, I've had other composers on and it's like mathematics to me.
Huh.
Where this magic comes from. Now, do you always know where you're going when you're composing, or is it a discovery landscape for you while you're doing it, too? Or do you know where the destination is?
I think there's some combination of both. I mean, I think at least what works for me, and again, it might not work for somebody else, but I guess I try to have a sense of the shape of the piece or what it is I am trying to do. I mean, some things are useful just to have an overview of, well, what instruments are you writing for? Those are important things to decide early on, and how long is it going to be, and is it one big movement or a bunch of little vignettes, or, you know, you kind of get some of those things down. I think then you start mapping out maybe even some other things that you want in the piece or that you know work well in pieces. And again, you use other, you know, the materials that maybe inspired you to begin with. And it's some kind of back and forth between, you know, sort of intuition, you know, head and heart, I think,
mm-hmm.
back and
mm-hmm.
forth and
that's,
combined.
That's what I would think.
Yeah. And I'm starting to be a little more free, I think, with myself and letting my intuition guide me a little bit more. And it seems to be working a little bit better for me.
Well, what did you use before you used intuition?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when we teach music composition, for example, sometimes we say to, you know, our students, oh, so what is the form of this piece, you know? Mm-hmm. And they say, well, I don't know, I haven't figured it out yet, you know? Or, you know, when we use words like, oh, well, is it ABA, or is it a binary form, or is it this form, or is it theme and variations? Or, you know, we kind of get them thinking about that early on, but sometimes that can be a little bit stifling, and I think there are probably some really interesting available forms out there that would be created if we didn't have an agenda right away at the beginning. And so I guess I'm
intellectualizing it.
Yeah, and so I'm just allowing myself to be more, I don't know, forgiving or something of myself and of my students, and it seems like some more interesting things are happening that way.
Yeah. Now, all of us, whether we're composers or not, we've all heard music from the moment we were born, practically. Do you find that it's hard to find an original voice with all this other music crammed into your head from almost day one?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that sort of anxiety of influence and all that kind of stuff. I think some composers are more worried about it than others, and it definitely doesn't do anybody any good to sort of worry about that stuff. So I think it's one of those things where, you know, we don't create out of a vacuum. And I think, you know, there is some, you know, we take stuff in and we need to digest it and sort of make it our own. I also think it's sort of impossible not to sort of, if you're really honest about what you like and dislike, it's sort of impossible for your individuality not to come out unless you're really sort of writing what you think somebody else wants you to write. So if you really are just saying, oh, I like this, this sounds nice to me, let's do that some more, I want to develop that, then probably your voice is going to emerge.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of the influence.
Yeah.
And you have to be enriching as well.
And I think within any, you know, the style doesn't really matter so much, you know, and I think any given voice will come out within any given style. And mm-hmm. So my style has, I guess, changed over the years, but I hope that in any of those styles, something about me was present.
The Sally Lamb.
Whatever that is, yeah.
Now, I want to listen to one of your pieces. It's called Processio.
Yes.
To tell us a little bit about it, and then we'll listen to it.
Okay, it's about a 10-minute piece for orchestra, and it was premiered by the Ithaca College Symphony Orchestra, and Jeffrey Myers conducting. And it was a piece, I guess the procession, I guess, that's sort of at work in the piece, I imagine this character kind of moving through a number of different scenarios. And so I used a kind of a theme and variations, I guess, through the piece. So the theme gets kind of tweaked along the way. But I would say it's very sort of through composed, because I do think of it as a bit of a journey. You'll hear different musics at work as well. I did overlap things, and as I imagine this character moving through, you might hear, you know, a little duet between the clarinet and bassoon happening sort of on the side that's sort of oblivious to some of the other music that's going on. And I guess it's very Ivesian, you know, in a way, to overlap different musics one on top of the other. But it's something that stimulates me and I find kind of exciting to listen to, and isn't so different from the world around us. You know, you walk down the street, you're walking down Cuga Street, and you hear some music maybe being piped out of one store, and somebody's playing a radio in the car, and then you hear just the street noise and people talking. And So sometimes if I just sort of listen to the world around me, that gives me ideas for
music. Well, let's listen to a minute of it. Really a lovely piece. I think it's a very lovely piece, and it does take you through so many different layers.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Now, are you thinking in terms of audience when you compose?
Well, I guess, you know, we write this music called concert music, or some people have said art music, or whatever you want to call it. Those labels seem to be kind of getting more and more, or less and less useful, I guess, and I start to sort of question them as well. So, and our audiences are seem to be changing too. And
in what ways?
And maybe even getting smaller. Well, I think as we start to incorporate different musics, you know, my background with music, my experience with music is somewhat eclectic, at least from my point of view. And so I think as I begin to sort of draw from those musics and my musical heritage, you know, I've noticed other people, you know, might say, wow, I didn't think I would like that kind of music or music for orchestra, but hey, I can relate to that piece, you know. So I've had people coming to hear my pieces that might not normally go to a classical concert or whatever you want to call it. But I also do notice that we don't seem to have sort of a regular audience so much anymore, and it seems to be diminishing. At least that's what I sense.
That's sad. I've talked to a lot of composers about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do hear about the death of classical music, and it is dwindling, but it's still very much alive, proof being that all you guys are still composing.
Yeah, and I think just because it's getting, if we're becoming more of a minority, I don't know if that's true, but it still doesn't make it any less worthwhile, and I guess I just have to trust that what I'm doing is meaningful and that there's some purpose in it.
Mm-hmm. Now, whenever I talk to nonfiction and fiction writers, they talk about the importance of making sure that their students and aspiring writers read everything. Do you feel that way? Do you tell your students that they really should listen to all kinds of different
I do. I really encourage them.
Traditions and so on?
I do. I encourage them to listen, of course, to the music sort of within our tradition, but also definitely encourage them to listen to other traditions. They seem to be doing that anyway, so I don't think it takes much encouragement to do that. I mean, it's hard not to. I have a student writing for a beatboxer right now and
really?
A couple of singers, and which I think is, you know, it's fantastic, you know, and but he has a whole other level of experience to sort of bring to that, so I'm very curious to see how, what he does with that, and it's fun for me. I learn a lot from my students.
Uh-huh. Have you seen the classical music traditions change a lot with the high-tech world that we're now living in and people being able to manipulate with computers? How has that changed things, do you think? Is it less pure?
I don't know if the artistry is less pure. Yeah, that's a tough question. I wouldn't say so. I mean,
or does it just expand the field and people can use to make sounds? Perhaps?
Yeah, I would be happy to say that it really just expands the palette of expression.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you could make some not very interesting art with the same instruments we've been using for hundreds of years, just as you could make some not very, you know, interesting art with new technology, you know. So I don't really think of that the technology is somehow bad for us.
Are you a composer that takes advantage of the new technology, or are you a traditionalist?
I'm pretty much a traditionalist. I mean, I have had some experience with electronic music, and you know, as an undergraduate, I think most of us are required to kind of explore that. But I do find myself just really attracted to mostly acoustic instruments. I don't explore a lot of the electronic possibilities right now.
Do you think you ever will?
Maybe. I wouldn't rule it out, you know.
Yeah, but I know you're a traditionalist, eh?
I am, I guess. But, you know, writing not necessarily traditional music with traditional instruments, I guess, you know, that's a possibility, too. And mm-hmm. I guess that interests me.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've received numerous commissions from various places. Did you approach commissions differently than when you're wanting to create something just out of your own imagination?
Not too much. I mean, I think only insofar as there are some limitations that the commissioner would give you. One of the pieces that we'll hear today that was commissioned by Percy Browning for the Cornell Women's Chorus, and the director of that, Scott Tucker, did have some specific requests. You know, he wanted me to use some American women poets, and he also wanted me to use texts that were maybe a little less typical for what a lot of women's choruses or chorales sing. You know, a lot of times they sing about, you know, birds and flowers and the niceties of and broken hearts. And so he wanted something a little more, I don't know, grit, I guess, or, you know, that just dealt with subjects that were maybe a little bit deeper than that. And so that was a really exciting challenge for me.
Uh-huh. Do you have much creative freedom when you have a commission? Do you get to...
Yeah, I don't.
Use your voice.
I think most people who commission a work, you know, someone who commissions you probably commissions you because they already like some stuff that you've done and they trust that you're going to treat their commission with care and not just, you know, or I suppose you could do something radical and just totally give them something they've never heard from you before. But I think most people who commission works already have. They're already willing to take a risk, and there's something exciting for them about that, too. They want something new, and their approach to it is very healthy in that way.
Uh-huh. Do composers actually go out and look for commissions?
Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, organizations that try to match commissioning ensembles with composers who want commissions. There's just so many different ways to approach it, but, you know, I think we're always... looking for opportunities to write music and get paid for it.
There's the key.
Yeah, there's the key, you know.
Now,
we all have to eat, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, creating music is obviously not a solo endeavor. How do you get an orchestra or an ensemble to paint the picture that you have in your head? Is that process really a difficult one, translating what you've written and having all these people have to interpret it?
Yeah, and that seems to take shape over time in rehearsals, and so if you're lucky enough to go to more than one rehearsal, or even over the course of a single rehearsal, you're always trying to sort of figure out how much of what you maybe don't like, what they're playing, is your problem. You know, did you just communicate it poorly on paper, or are they just misunderstanding what you want? And so there was some dialogue there about that. And you have to kind of go back and forth and figure out as a composer, well, what can I do better in representing what I'm hearing on paper? It's tricky. We have these symbols that we use, and there are multiple interpretations for every note on the paper, and you know, we try to figure out how to do that.
Is it important for a composer to know a lot about the instruments that you're composing for?
Yeah.
In other words, you know, tell people how to make the colors that you see.
Absolutely. It's a big part of our job is really appreciating what the instrument does best and how to make it sound, you know, as best as it can and really feature the good points of that instrument. And so I guess I consider myself a lifelong student. I think most of us do, you know, and really trying to understand the instruments, and then even more so, or I don't know about more so, but in addition to understanding the player, I find it helpful now to kind of know who I'm writing for, and sometimes that inspires me creatively and musically. But it definitely, you know, if I have sort of an image in my mind of the performer, even their personality and what they bring to it, that's a part of it too.
Now, I want to listen to the piece that you just mentioned, this vocal piece that had poetry and so on, and it's called Tide Rises.
Yes.
And I'd like to listen to a little bit. Is there anything else you want to tell us about that?
Well, it combines two texts, as they'll hear. There's the Longfellow poem, The Tide Rises, The Tide Falls, and also mapped onto that is Row, Row, Row Your Boat. And something about the Longfellow poem just, there was something kind of dreamy about it, a little melancholy, and so I don't know why, but I just thought it would be interesting to sort of map on Row, Row, Row Your Boat because of that text and sort of the feeling of, I don't know, life is but a dream. And
well, let's just listen to some of it. That's a gorgeous piece. It really is. I love choruses.
Thank you.
Do you know that something's going to turn out that beautiful? Or did you end up having to add or subtract certain voices when you're doing these
no,
kinds of...
No, that one really did start to write itself, and that's always such a gift, you know, when that happens and you feel like, oh, you're really on to something. And it's so simple in ways, but I was just... That's where I just am thankful that it happened the way it happened, and you start to feel like, gee, who's writing this, you know? But, you know, where
really?
You're part of
it. So that was the inspiration thing, right? It just sort of came out of you?
It did.
Who's writing this?
Yeah, a little bit. Or you just think, I had a good day writing, you know, and then it wrote itself pretty quickly within a few days. And
really gorgeous.
And sometimes I think for composers, we're best when we just sort of get out of our own way. And
that's what you were referring to earlier.
Yeah.
You know, let the intuition show up.
And not that you couldn't have studied and done your homework beforehand. I mean, I guess I shouldn't underestimate that either. I mean,
we have to come to the table with tools.
Right? Yeah, that's right. I mean, we do need to hone our skills and keep those sharp and keep learning and all that. But then I think at that point, then we can kind of take some stock and intuition.
I want you to tell us about Cool Music Contemporary Chamber Ensemble, which you are the artistic director of. Tell us about the evolution of this and how fun is this?
It's a lot of fun. When I started at Ithaca College a little over 2 years ago, Dean Ostrander, who was dean at that time, asked me to be in charge of a contemporary chamber ensemble because it really hadn't received a lot of attention prior to that. And so I took that on. I had never done anything like that before, but I was excited about it and, you know, gave it this name. Cool Music was just kind of a contemporary, fun spelling, K-U-L-M-U-S-I-K, because I wanted to be doing, like, literally cool music from around the world and a lot of music that was written recently by, you know, living composers.
Including yourself.
Including myself. This is actually the first time I've actually programmed myself, so I did hold off on that for a while. So.
Really?
Yeah, because there are just so many great pieces out there, and it's not really meant to be about me, you know, it's about the students. And then the other thing that was so important to me was to create an ensemble that combined faculty and students so that the students could work alongside their teachers and really get at some sometimes very difficult contemporary music, some thorny stuff that they might not tackle otherwise. But if they're playing with their teacher, you know, what a great opportunity for everybody. So it's kind of a family approach, I guess, to learning and playing. And we've also commissioned a work. I started this Cool Music Composition Contest open to Ithaca College composers. And so, you know, again, I'm stimulating and trying to generate more new music.
Oh, I think that's great. Just keeping these traditions alive
is
amazing to me. Now, when we only have a couple minutes left. You teach music composition. Now, how does a composer know when he or she's ready to start teaching? Was that a hard transition for you?
I don't know if we're ever ready, but, you know, there is that sort of saying, you really learn something when you have to teach it, you know, and I don't know. I think the more I started doing it, I really enjoyed it, and so that seemed like a good sign that I seemed to be suited for it.
And how do you inspire your students? Did you have little tips or rules that Sally Lamb conveys to them?
I don't know. Maybe they would say so. I'm not sure what they are, I guess. It just seems to be a part of my everyday life. So,
And I know you studied with Stephen Stuckey. What did you learn from him?
Well, I learned a lot from Steve. And maybe the greatest gift that he gave me was probably, I think he really opened my ears up to possibilities. And I think I was a lot more judgmental than I was willing to acknowledge at that time. You know, I think I had sort of a pretty limited sort of value set of sort of how music is supposed to go at that point. So I think he was really helpful for me in just, you know, just really accepting a number of possibilities for the kind of music that we write, you know, which is very multifaceted. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, just kind of removing some of those preconceived ideas.
Mm-hmm. And can you imagine your life without music?
No, it would be hard to do that, you know. I mean, it would be, I guess, kind of a sad life. I mean, I could imagine different possibilities for myself, you know, and how music would play a role in my life. But I think, you know, I would always want music to be a part of my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sally Lamb, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tish. It's been a pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.